Welcome to Elements of Styles, the business podcast that trades in scarce thinking for community, conversation, and ideas in abundance. Each week, I, Mark Styles, sit with professionals and entrepreneurs, both local and global, and learn how they each add value to their communities, their partners, and their teams. Please enjoy. I am really, really excited for today's guest. We were his guest on his podcast, which has over a million unique downloads. Can't wait to talk to him about that. But this guy, he rang the bell at Remax, which is a term I am now fully versed on. Worldwide number one Remax agent, then shifted gears, went to Keller Williams, another internationally massive real estate brokerage firm, rang the bell there as their number one agent. Then the New York Times stated that his book was in their top 10 best-selling books, Six Steps to Seven Figures. We're going to talk about that. He has a foreword from the one and only Gary Keller, sat on the stage with Gary Keller, talked about that book. He is a podcast superstar, as I had mentioned. He's interviewed folks like Grant Cardone with the 10X. He is all over the internet. He is now coaching through his online platform called Rebus University. We're going to dig into that. He certifies listing agents, and he's an investor and a business owner, and he has multiple streams of income, including real estate properties, mastermind companies, and a number of other things. This is the real estate rock star, Pat Hyben. Pat, welcome to the show, my man.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
All right. Hey, let's get right into it, okay? How did you do it? How did you ring the bell at one of the largest real estate companies in the world? And then do it again.
Slowly, 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 suddenly, you know.
Slowly, slowly, suddenly. I love it. I love it. What's that mean, man?
I got into business in 1987.
All right.
The 90s was a interesting time for real estate. I mean, it wasn't good. It wasn't bad. It just was. You hustled and you made commissions and you were basically a true professional. There wasn't a lot of us. Fortunately for many of us, we were able, or I was able at least at that time, to build a surfboard, meaning a team, a strong team in the late 90s. And so when that wave hit, my surfboard was strong and I was able to ride that wave, and that's how we did it.
How big was the team by the time you were hitting the big team?
Well, you know, at our peak, we're at 50 some people, but that included a title company and a mortgage company. So, you know, I had my own company and then it was intact with a mortgage and a title. And so, you know, we had, I think, like 17 agents and then that work buyers. We had three that only work sellers. So that'd be about 20 agents.
You had a title company and a mortgage company all under the same umbrella?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you were an owner of all three of those companies?
Yep.
Wow. How did they work? Did they work well together?
Yeah. We had a unique thing going on. It was all RESPA compliant. We were able to give ownership interest to all of the agents. And so they would get profit checks every quarter.
Referring within the affiliated business?
Not for referring. That would be illegal, but for, you know, just for being an agent, right?
Got it. You know, so it was like a profit share.
Yeah. They own part of the company. I mean, cool. That was just it. It was just set up that way. You know what I mean? And even if they didn't refer it, they still got paid. You know, that allows it to be compliant. And so anyways, it was fun times, man. That was a good time.
Yeah, it was. So what year was it that you rang the bell at Remax?
2004.
Four, okay. And then you left, started your own company, and then transferred that company.
Then I went over to Keller Williams, yeah.
Okay, cool. And you rang the bell again. Same team, same concept, but different model.
Yeah.
Are you still getting downline streams with Keller?
Yeah, I think I'm about 40 grand, somewhere between 30 and 40,000 a year. Because what happens is, people don't think about this and build big teams, but I still have a lot of members that were part of my team back then that are still in the business that are now at Keller Williams. And so they've built teams of their own and, you know, I still get profit from them. And then I've met people along the way and they've joined and built big things. And so,
and that check just shows up in the bank account. No questions asked. You created this, you originated this, the downline is yours forever.
Yeah. Yeah. Until the offices that the people are attached to stop profiting, or the people, you know, leave the business, eventually downlines trickle. They actually won't if they continue to recruit, I guess. And if they recruit, then they get out of the business in the middle.
Yeah.
The people at the bottom kind of run up the top. So it kind of could live forever.
That's pretty cool. So would you consider that one of your horizontal lines of income?
Yes.
What else you got kicking in your horizontal line?
I own 8% of a Keller Williams office that pays profit. I get a profit share from my real estate team that my guy, Mike Sloan, my top agent, took over in 2010. I get royalties from my book, Six Steps to Seven Figures, and the audio version of my book, Six Steps to Seven Figures. I get, I have a whole bunch of little single family houses in College Park, Maryland, and Baltimore City, and I have 7 apartment buildings that I'm part of. I have a shopping center I'm a part of. I have several notes for companies that I loan money to that pay dividends. And then I have several other companies that I own a percentage in that I invested in or am involved in.
Now, I listened to one of the podcasts where you were saying your goal was to get to 50 different horizontal lines. Where are you at now?
Yeah, I'm at like 42. They fluctuate because what happens is, we'll have an apartment building and it'll make sense to sell it, so we'll sell it, or we'll pull it out of something and put it in, or we'll sell 2 houses and put it in one thing. So the numbers are constantly moving.
How did you get into the real estate business from the giddy up? You're in college, you're wondering what to do, and all of a sudden you're the number one real estate agent in the world.
Yeah. How's that happen? Slowly, surely. But it wasn't like that.
It wasn't an overnight success story.
And it wasn't a conscious one, really. I mean, it was, but it wasn't. I mean, it was conscious in the fact that here's the only thing that was conscious about me getting into real estate was that I saw that the commissions were big and I saw that I didn't need a boss. So I was never really good at sports. I'm very uncoordinated. And so I think that early on, I developed like a dislike for bosses or authority figures, because to me, they were all dicks because they were yelling at me because I was so uncoordinated, right? So I couldn't do anything right. So why should I like somebody who's considered a coach or a boss, right? Because I was dropping things and missing goals and things in soccer. So I was like, screw this. I want to be my own boss. So I just became my own boss, and that was attractive. And then the other thing that was attractive was that at that time, the commissions were a couple $1,000 where my friends were getting out of college and selling something and making $50 or $100 a sale. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. Why not make $1,000 or $2,000 or $3,000 a sale rather than $50 and be my own boss at the same time? So I think those two things actually made me say, let me do real estate. Nothing else. It wasn't like, oh, I love fireplaces or I loved, dealing with people making decisions or anything like that. It just kind of happened.
So a couple things come to mind. So coaches, you had kind of bad experience with them, therefore you analogize them to bosses. What about teachers? Did you have the same experience with teachers telling you, hey, man, you didn't do your homework?
I think I was good enough. I got a 2.6 in college. I mean, that was like, it's not a bad student. It's not a fail out student, but it's not a great student. But there were teachers that I liked and teachers I didn't like. I mean, I don't think the relationship was long enough, right? Like a semester only lasts like 3 months. So it really didn't give you enough time to like.
What about as a kid though? Where you got the teacher all year long.
I don't remember it like that. I remember it more of just a social thing. My parents didn't put that much pressure on us to, accelerate. It's not like it is today, right? The GPA back then, there wasn't this massive pressure, for the GPA, at least in my mind, that didn't seem like that. It was a pressure, I guess, to graduate, but there wasn't this pressure like, oh shit, you got to get, an A+ in every class.
Right. And it is now. Now, it's funny. You talk about grades and just kind of push it through. It seems like it's a very similar characteristic with most entrepreneurs, right? Like school wasn't on the highest of priority lists. Yet they probably could have got 4.0s if they decided that that was it. But as you mentioned, there's a social element to it. At what point did you realize you're an entrepreneur?
Great question. I was about 20.
Okay.
And I had had jobs in restaurants and that sort of thing where I was trading time for money, probably 10 of them, 10 different ones, right? I got a job. A friend of mine did this job, which basically I was living down at the beach in Ocean City, Maryland. They were building a timeshare, which was kind of new then. And they needed to get people to come into the timeshare. So they got a bunch of kids to go out onto the public places and tell people if they take a tour of this timeshare, they get a $50 gift certificate to a local restaurant. And if you got someone to take this tour, you got a $20 commission. And they used to post the results of everybody's commissions that they got people to go. And generally, average person might get one or two, okay, right? I think you got a nominal hourly fee, but then you got a $20 bonus for everybody you got. And so they would post everybody's numbers and they'd say 1-1-1-2-2-1-0-0, whatever. And I remember there was this kid that he was like the top salesman. They used to call him the golden boy, and he would always get five, right? He would get a lot of fives and make $100 a day. And I remember the second day, I think, we get there in the morning for the morning huddle, and they have everybody's numbers up, and my number was 101, and it said 101, and then it said 6. So,
nice.
Like, my first day on the job, I got 6 people to go take this tour, and he turns to his buddies, and I'm standing right beside him, and he goes, and he got 5, right? And he goes, who in the fuck is 101?
Love it. Love it.
And I just—
Did you stand up and raise your hand?
Yeah, I was just standing behind him. I just smiled, you know, and I was just like, wow, this is great. And another thing happened that day too. At the time, I was working in a deli, and I was slicing meats for like $5 or $6 an hour. And I would literally make like $120 a week slicing meats. And I was doing this on my 2 off days. And I had this realization. I made $120 in one day.
Yeah.
Where slicing meats, I made $120 in one week, and I literally did not go back to the deli. I didn't even go for a single day. After that, I was like, this is just so much more exciting and so much smarter for me to be here. And so then the next day, I just went back and started getting more people to go to this restaurant, you know?
So you never punched a clock from that day forward?
Never.
That's awesome. So that brings me to my next question about entrepreneurs. What we're focusing on our podcast is entrepreneurs. And every entrepreneur comes from a different background, right? They rose up, they awakened, they became who they are in a different path. So we're trying to see who each one is. And so some listener can say, hey, that kind of, you know, that guy, Pat Hyman, he sounds like me. I could do that, right? Let me hear what he's got to say. But the question is, are all entrepreneurs born, or is it learned? Ooh, I got a nice pause from the man.
That's a tough one, you know. I think it's like anything in life, to be honest with you. I think it's more nature than nurture, just to be honest with you. If I had to pick one, I would pick nature. Like, a lot of the people that I know that are entrepreneurs are just born to think a lot differently. But at the same time, I've had friends who have become entrepreneurs late in life. Like, they've worked at a business for 20 years and the guy goes to sell it, right? And he goes, I'll sell it to you since you've worked here 20 years, and they buy it and it thrives. And suddenly they're a business owner.
Right.
So would I say they're entrepreneurial? Yes, 100%, because they're a business owner. Would I define that fully as an entrepreneur? Well, I kind of think entrepreneurism contains with it in it a sense of ADD, like a sense of,
yep,
a sense of, okay, I'm going to do all this different shit, like doing different things, right? I mean, do you define entrepreneurs, is a business owner an entrepreneur?
You know, it depends. It depends. I mean, now we can jump over to Rich Dad, Robert Kiyosaki, and you've got the employee right? The self owned business. And then you have the real business owner, and then you've got the investor.
Investor. You know, so the I quadrant, right? Would you say that the I quadrant is an entrepreneur? So if that's the case, the person that I might describe as, you know, buying a business is not necessarily an entrepreneur until they go and buy a couple rental properties, have another little side hustle going on online, selling, you know, hats, investing in this company here. You know what I mean? Like, if that's the definition of entrepreneur, I think that's definitely more of a natural thing.
Like taking on risk, right? Accepting risk, falling on your face and just wiping off.
And being okay with variety.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you could say, myself included, I was a real estate agent for a long time. And is that an entrepreneur, right? If all I do is sell real estate, am I an entrepreneur?
I think so. I mean, you're definitely running your own business. You're self-employed at a minimum.
Why wouldn't I be a business owner or a self-employed?
You're in that self-employed or business owner. I see the I quadrant for Kiyosaki as the passive, where you really want to be, the passive income stream, where you don't have to do anything but exist and the check comes in.
I mean, you would have to define entrepreneur. You know what I mean?
Is it definable?
That's the hard part to do, right?
So what you said, I haven't heard yet. You know, a lot of them have the same characteristics. They've got the ADD. You know, they're great storytellers, right? You're a phenomenal storyteller, very humble. You have no problem saying, I sucked at sports. You know, I failed at this or I failed at that, or the market crashed and I hated selling real estate. But most that I see, it's optimism. Right? There's always a silver lining beyond where they are at that moment in time.
Yeah. It's a belief, right? Kind of a having faith.
Yeah.
And that's great. And it's funny you say that, because recently I was talking with a guy, right? Raising money for his company. I may or may not invest, but he said, well, what's holding you back? And I said, well, to be honest with you, I invested in 16 companies in the last 10 years and three have gone out of business completely. I've lost everything. Luckily for me, you know, we're not talking a large percentage of my net worth, right? Just because I have so much little ones, right? So he said, well, what looking back, you know, and I, you know, what made you decide to invest with them? I was like, well, they were just so intelligent and they were just so sure of themselves and almost positive in a manic sense that they were going to make this happen, that I believe that their belief equaled success at all costs, right? Looking back and realizing that all entrepreneurs have what you just said, have that extreme positivity.
Yep, which could be pie in the sky.
A friend of mine calls it hopium.
Hopium, that is awesome. I'm going to use that.
You know, hopium. And so you got to watch yourself, you know. And, you know, one of the things he does, one of my partners, David Osborne, everybody he's going into business with, he has a Anthony Robbins DISC test done online. Yep. And, you know, if they come out a high I, high I's tend to have a lot of hopium. And when you're dealing with a high I, you need to watch yourself. Don't mistake that hopium for a sure thing.
Right.
So, you know, we can talk about that test all day long, but, you know, analyze the results of that test. And it doesn't mean they're going to fail if they're high. It just means they have a tendency to be convincing with their hopium. There's companies that I'm invested in now that, you know, every time I talk to them, they're like, they're always telling me about some meeting that they got down the road or some merger that they're going to do or some acquisition or some account that is going to start using them, right? But it's always about that, and I never see a profit check.
And these are ones that you're thinking about investing or invest?
No, I have investments in now. You know, I don't. It's, you know, investing.
How involved are you with those guys, though?
Just passively, not at all. Yeah. And that's the problem is, you know, with real estate, you know what it is, you know what you're getting, you know what the returns are, you know what you need to do if it's not working. And you're in control, right? With investing in companies, it's a whole nother thing. Everybody is spouting hopium. Nobody wants to say things are going wrong. And if they're not going good, they just go out of business. I mean, it's just, we're going on a tangent here.
Yeah, but that's it's a great cool discussion. Because it's interesting how you analyze an investment, right? So a lot of it sounds like, you know, you see a guy like yourself and you're like, okay, I know that characteristic. He's a doer. He's going to get it done because he kind of reminds me of me, right? I've got that spunk. I've got that spark. But are you, I mean, are they giving you executive summaries with track records and analysis on, you know, we're not just hoping to have a contract with Amazon. We have a contract with Amazon, you know, whatever that might be with the different company.
Yeah. It's just hard to tell. That's all.
Yeah. Sometimes you take a flyer, right? It's like your own personal venture.
They're all flyers, dude.
Yeah. I heard you talk about the marijuana industry on one of the podcasts that I was doing some research on you. I strongly urge all of my listeners to check out Pat's podcast, Real Estate Rockstars. You could find him. He's all over the internet. You just Google Pat Hyben. You could do Hyben Digital. You can do Rebus University. He's all over the internet, and he's got some gems out there. What you were talking about with respect to starting your own streams of income. I mean, that's the ultimate goal, right? So how do you leap from self-employed to business owner without, you know, I heard you refer to it as the caterpillar and the cocoon and the butterfly. You know, it's not without pain to step back and let someone control your baby, if you will, right?
Yeah. Okay. So that's a great discussion. That's one of the ones I had with Robert Kiyosaki that kept coming up. I actually, before I interviewed him, I asked a lot of people, if you had one question, what would it be? And that was it, going from the S, the self-employed, to the business owner, and then from the business owner to the investor. People struggle with that. And I think a lot of people struggle with that last one, going from the business owner to the investor, because they have a belief, which is rightly or wrongly, nobody knows. Only the universe knows. They have a belief that they're going to build a company and then they're going to sell a company, right? Or maybe get enough money out of that company so that when they do retire, they can just close it and they've saved enough money.
So they're trying to begin with the end in mind, yet that might not be the
you don't know.
Proper, right. You may own this business and be punching a clock in your own business.
It'd be great today. And then, you know, something happens and you don't know. I mean, I was just this past weekend, I was just, you know, in Ellicott City, Maryland during the floods and all these businesses, there's about 20 businesses. I was in one of them eating lunch with my wife and a flood happened, right? A freak flood. Today, it's only been 48 hours. There's 20 businesses or more that are shut down.
Wow.
Full of mold and dampness and water. And, you know, it's obviously going to screw up their entire profit for the next year and everything else. My point is, you don't know,
right?
You know, whether something's going to keep going for you or not.
Right.
You hope that it does. And the way to protect yourself on that is to hedge yourself through other investments, which I've done. So what I started doing was trying to hit singles, you know, rather than home runs. So, you know, make a little money selling some real estate and then taking that commission and buying a little house and renting the house out. And then doing it again.
And you found some success with college towns?
Yeah, I like college towns, providing, you know, again, it's you never know what's going to happen. So,
right.
So I did like college towns, and then, you know, I'm in the University of Maryland, and all of a sudden they've built like five giant high rises, and it's actually suppressed the rent. Rents are going down because they built all these apartments. So supply and demand. And then before that, they tried to institute rent control. There was a 3-year period where they were trying to institute rent control, and it finally went away with the political office. You know, you wait long enough, laws come in, laws go. Yeah. I spend most of my time in Charleston. They just banned Airbnbs unless you own the house, unless you're owner occupant, meaning I can rent out a room, but I can't, you know, buy another house or rent another house and Airbnb it anymore. So
how can they stop you from doing that though?
How can they not?
Well, do they levy fines? I mean,
$1,000 a day.
Really? Because they have a strong hotel lobby, or what's the purpose behind that? I mean, I know Charleston's a really nice town. I get that, sure, but it's not like you're getting riffraff.
Well, if I had a hotel, you know, I would bitch about it, right? Uh-huh. And if I owned a house and someone kept having bachelorette parties or bachelor parties next door,
yeah,
I might bitch about it if I had little kids. That's what governments do, man.
I know, but it's my property. That's my land. This is America. You know, I'm going to rent my property the way I want to. I mean, it's how do you then put a law down of something, you know, I've already been owning this land.
Well, do you have a rental license?
Is that what they do in Charleston?
Yeah.
So, but I didn't need a rental license when I bought this house. That's kind of arbitrary. And
well, most towns have rental licenses.
Yeah.
Well, I shouldn't say most. I know.
So Airbnb is a really cool company. So I've obviously used it. I enjoy the platform. You know, have you seen it in your world? Are you using it at all?
Well, I don't buy rentals and rent them out Airbnb, but I do know people that do.
Yeah.
You know, I know people that have 10, 20, 30 houses that they rent out Airbnb.
And, so it's
and,
like
a, and hopefully it'll continue on. They make a ton of money. There's a ton of profit, but you don't know, right? You don't know what's going to happen.
No, you sure don't. I mean, so they set it up almost like a centralized fractured hotel, if you will, right? So they've got units all over the place, and then they've got one management system.
Yeah.
That's an online platform.
Exactly. Yep.
It's brilliant.
It poses as a bed and breakfast, right?
Yeah.
They have like one guy I know, right? His wife is hot, so he puts like her face on there.
Yep.
And it says like Mindy, and it says, you know, she's the owner.
Yeah.
But it's kind of a farce. It's not it's not really her coming out and making you pancakes.
No, it's an LLC collecting.
An LLC, he owns 30 of them, and you know they're all on lockbox, and you get the combo to the lock. It's not really a B&B.
Yeah, it's an interesting platform. You know what I want to talk about, though? So again, Robert Kiyosaki, his book was very influential for me. I read Rich Dad Poor Dad at a time that, you know, it really moved and impacted me. So listening to that podcast, which again, my listeners, if you are going to listen to just one of Pat Hyben's and then subscribe, go to this one with Robert Kiyosaki. He called the market, right? 2016 on your show, he basically said, this thing's crashing. Now, obviously he called it early.
Because it hasn't crashed yet, right?
No, I mean,
he was doom and gloom, right?
Yeah, but you know, he wasn't doom and gloom. What he said, you know, made perfect sense. I just think he might have called it too early.
That's how it is with all those guys. Nobody could call it. You know, and then it'll crash and he'll be like, I called it, because he was calling it from like 15 to 19.
Yeah.
Right. So long as he doesn't change his tune, he'll be able to say, I called it, you know, or you can change your tune, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, of course. I mean, there were people calling the subprime and, you know, the Bear Stearns, and they were calling.
Very few. Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I wasn't.
Saw funny how you saw
Big Short.
Big Short.
Right? Oh, yeah. Oh,
very
yeah.
few, yeah. Very few were going all in with the short. Right?
Yeah. But you know what he said that I found really interesting when he was calling it is he said, you know, I live in a very affluent neighborhood. One side of the street are much more valuable homes, because I'm assuming it's on a river or something like that. And then there's the other side of the street that are similar in homes, but, you know, less valuable. And he said, the cheaper homes are selling, but the higher valued premium homes are not. And that's a trigger point for him to say, this is a sign of bad things to come. What do you think of that?
I think that's a problem. And I'll tell you, I'm not like him calling stuff out.
Yeah.
You know, I don't got time for that. But I have a concern that, let's call them mega mansions.
Yeah.
Could potentially.
Like 7,000 square feet, 65.
And up, right?
Okay.
Could potentially see a massive amount of depreciation in the future. And I'll tell you why. My wife and I went to Memphis, Tennessee. And one of the things you do in Memphis is you go to Graceland.
Oh, yeah.
And you go, I got to go to Graceland because this is where the king lived. Elvis Presley, the king. So you say this guy, he moved of all the places. He didn't go to Hollywood or whatever. He wanted to go to Memphis. So he built his dream house in Memphis, Tennessee. You go, okay, I'll pay $40 for a ticket to tour this dream house. this freaking dream house is like 2,350 square feet.
Yeah, it's a ranch.
It's a freaking ranch.
I've been there. I love it.
You know, the pool is like the biggest, big as my office, right?
Yep, yep.
And I'm thinking, okay, what's wrong with this picture? Like, this used to be where the king lived, where the richest guy in America, or people perceived as being one of the richest guys, is living. And now you have accountants that are building, that work for a corporation, that are building 8,000 square foot houses, right? So, you know, regular people. And so I think to myself, you know, what is going on with the distortion of how much space that we need? And now, and I have kids, my kids are in the 20s, low 20s.
They wouldn't buy one of those houses if you gave it to them, right?
You hate them. They don't want it.
Yeah, yeah.
My daughter is currently on a two-week trip. She just graduated college. She's on a two-week trip with everybody she went to college with. She was adamant at bringing everything she needed for this two-week trip in a carry-on backpack. You know, she didn't want all this crap being lugged around.
Yeah.
And she did it. And I think that that's how they think, right? Why would you, if you look at floor plans now, right? They're all open kitchen, family room, living room is like the kitchen room, right? It's just one big room. That's all they need. That and a bedroom and a bathroom, right? So
no such thing as a dining room anymore.
Yeah.
Why would you waste that space now, right?
Life happens.
Yeah.
Life happens outside. That's why festivals and things like that are so popular, right? That's where all the, you know, they want that activity. Now, there's some that will say, and this is true too, you know, people are spending more time cocooned, you know, when on their cell phones and their computers and stuff. But to still, when you're in cocooning, you don't need a massive house to cocoon in and go to this one room. They're usually stuck in one room.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of people cocoon. Like I know someone who has a cocooning problem. And this person cocoons in the bedroom, right? Yeah. They retreat to the bedroom for 5-6 hours a day and cocoon. So, you know, it's not like that person needs 12 rooms to cocoon in. So, I think that it makes sense to me that Kiyosaki's right, and you will see a massive depreciation in mega mansions. And I even saw one article online, a guy would say, what are they going to do with all these houses?
That's a great question. It's a great question.
I mean, it's not zone commercial. The people, the governments are not going to want them to suddenly be zone commercial. And what good would commercial real estate do you if it's way out where nobody lives? Right. So
what did he say they're going to do? No answer.
The guy in the article, he had some goofy rent out room by room.
Yeah.
Like mini like hotels or whatever, or month to month rentals or each room, which makes sense. You know, old folks homes is a good one for elderly. He had one idea of making them like tourist attractions, but he had all kinds of weird ideas. I can't remember. Incubators for companies.
Yeah. It's amazing. So what I've seen some convert to condos if it's in a location that's suited for that. So if you're near the water or something like that, they can turn them to condos. But those neighborhoods where you pull in and it's one way in, one way out, 47 houses at 6,500 square feet on 1 acre on top of each other. I mean, when they start selling for less than the 1,800 square foot ranches, I mean, you got to think deed sweep, take them all and repurpose the whole thing. You know, but people will sit tight. And I mean, that's one that I don't think is coming back. You know, that's an asset class that I just can't see the future generation saying, yeah, I'll pay $1,500 a month in heat.
The waste that the younger generation sees, and they almost look down upon, and I don't want to generalize because this isn't true, obviously, for every millennial.
Right.
But I do think it's an attitude that needs to be paid attention to that millennials perceive certain generations as extremely wasteful fiscally when it comes to the primary residence, let's say, right?
Yeah.
And among other things too, cars, right? What I need a car for, just Uber everywhere, right? Yeah. And they also are placing a much higher value on experiences, right? So given the choice, you know, you got $1,000, you can take a 2-week vacation across the United States and stay at Airbnbs and campsites, or you could have $1,000 watch. You gave that option to 100 millennials. I'd be curious to see the results.
Right. And that explains why they're delaying entering into the purchase market, which is why, you know, we're up here in Boston and they keep building luxury rentals. And I keep saying to myself, is it sustainable? Yet they keep getting 95% occupancy rates because these guys, you know, again, we don't want to generalize a whole generation, but a lot of them are saying, hey, I don't know how long I'm going to be here. You know, this company's great now, but I may want to jump down to Charleston. You know, Pat lives down there. It's cool as hell down there.
So they'll be fine so long as the housing market keeps going the way it has, because then you have the ability to have a transaction. But, you know, what people don't realize is that everything comes in cycles, and there will be a time when that ability to have that liquid transaction won't exist, right? It'll be like, I want to sell my place. All right. Average summer market's 9 months. What do you mean? Yeah. You might sell for less than you paid. What do you mean? Then it becomes a problem. Then people are reluctant to buy in it.
Let's not forget, you know, some of these kids grew up watching their parents get short sales, foreclosures. So they're probably gun shy. But I mean, how damaging is that to the injection to create wealth, right? I mean, you of all people, I mean, real estate, you got to get in, and you got to get in young.
Don't put all your eggs in one basket.
Yeah. Well, but if you're patient, real estate will take care of you.
Well, that's the thing. It's a patience game, right?
Yeah.
And it hits singles. Don't hit home runs. You certainly don't buy one of them condos as an investment, right? That's a, you know, buy a ghetto property and rent it out Section 8. Right. I mean, keep hitting singles. Don't try to hit home runs.
Or buy something to move into, which is what, you know, again, not generalizing on the whole
house hack it, right? Buy it in, move in, and
yeah, but they're not doing that, you know. So the rental market and the corporate private equity, they're doing fine with their buildings, but these kids aren't, you know, they're not getting that initial injection where if you had a house for 5 years, you know, you're going to sell it and you're going to put a little bit of money in your pocket or you're going to move up, right?
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about transactions real quick. Real estate agents out there, we got a lot of those listeners because, as you know, our core 7 methodology is based on 7 core professionals: real estate agent, loan professional, escrow officer, real estate attorney, financial advisor, CPA, property casualty, and estate planning attorney. So a lot of our listeners are real estate agents, and right now you're certifying the listing agent. Let's talk about Rebus University for a minute, can we?
Yeah, sure.
What are you doing?
We basically take training processes that real estate agents might not normally get in their office from their broker, from their office manager, like how to close every listing that you go on the appointment for. So we filmed 8 of the world's top agents do their listing appointments, right? Step by step. And then we turn it into a course and a certification called the Certified Listing Agent. And we sell it. And we did the same thing for buyer agent. We did the same thing for 12 different concepts. And that's what Rebus University is. We're able to train real estate agents in such a way that they can do it on their own, right?
Yeah.
They can do it online. They can watch. We do 5-minute videos with 5 questions. So we do, you know, 5 and 5, and they have to pass the quiz to get to the next one.
Oh, cool.
And that's kind of what we do. It's a way we're taking Real Estate Rockstars, which is a free format, and expanding on it in a lot of detail.
So how's it going?
It's going great. We have over 1,000 students.
Wow.
Online. Most of our reviews are all 5 stars. So I think it's going good.
Oh, that's awesome. So how do they access Rebus University? If they were to just say, you know what, this is a great conversation. This guy knows what he's talking about. He's rang the bell at 2 international companies. I'm in. I don't even want to think about it anymore. I'm in. How do they do that?
So what they can do is they can go to RebusUniversity.com, and I created a special coupon code for this interview here. So anybody listening to this, if you want to try us out and take the listing course, which is our most popular course on how to win every listing appointment, no matter what, just go to RebusUniversity.com, and in the checkout line, use the coupon code CLA, which is Certified Listing Agent, CLA50, the number 5 and the number 0, and that will give you 50% off. So half price here if you just use CLA50.
Wow. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate that. My listeners, take advantage of that. This guy is a wealth of knowledge, and it's an unbelievable course. I've seen a lot of what he's doing, and you know, check that out. Can you talk about your team a little bit, your personal team, not you as the real estate agent in the past, but who is on your team? Do you have a financial advisor? Who's the quarterback of your team?
Yeah, that's great. My team's a little more sophisticated than most, I think. So, you know, the first thing I have is I have a bookkeeper, let's call him, who keeps all my books, right? Yep. Like all the properties, all the money that comes in from the different places, provides reports, which I look at every month, which is very important. Then I have an accountant, right? Which is, you know, someone else that's very important. I have multiple attorneys. I have attorneys that, you know, business attorney, real estate attorney.
Estate planning attorneys?
Estate planning, yes.
What was Robert Kiyosaki talking about? He has asset protection attorneys. Did you remember that story he was telling about being shot at?
That was insane. Yeah,
that was unbelievable. He's telling a story because people know who he is and they know how wealthy he is. This group just took fire on him. That's frightening. Like I couldn't get my head around that. I had to keep rewinding that.
I don't know. If, you know,
you don't know how accurate it is.
Yeah. I don't know.
Why let facts?
He mentioned it, and I was like, well, I think it was just, you know, one thing you'll find. And I do the same thing. And, you know, anybody that speaks a lot tends to eventually the edges get rounded about the story, let's just say. So, but nonetheless, I mean, maybe it happened. Yeah, I mean, you got it. You know, one guy looked at my stuff at one point, and he's like, wow, you're really judgment proof, right? I mean, I've got like 16 LLCs. I've got, you know, tons of insurance. I've got every member of my family is like on the life lock payment plan because I've had, you know, my identity stolen. People try to get my tax return.
Really?
Shit like that. Oh yeah, man.
People come at you, not, you know, taking fire on you, but have people come at you and tried to do a sophisticated con?
No.
To try to get to you? No. So financial advisor, do you have a guy who just kind of watches the investments?
Yeah. I got a financial advisor who's like a paid advisor, right?
Yeah.
Who I paid to give me advice on this or that, you know, how I'm structured. I have a trust. I have a couple different things set up with my kids. And then I have a stockbroker, right? Who just is like stocks.
Now the
property manager.
Oh, yeah. You got to have the property manager, right? Do those people ever sit down at a table together and say, hey, we got to talk about Pat?
No, they don't. No.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm in deep enough to them. You know, I'm not that rich, right?
I don't know about that. And I don't think.
If you're talking, you know what I mean? I haven't reached that point yet. So, no, but maybe someday. Right?
So you don't have to be rich. You could have one home,
well,
and one check.
It'd be nice, right? It would be.
Yeah, nice. I've heard. I interviewed a guy who calls it the wealth table. Who sits at the table? Who's the quarterback, and who's bringing in everybody to sit around and say, "Hey, we might be missing something here with Pat. I don't know that he's got enough umbrella insurance to cover some of these assets. Indeed, and what about the, you know, succession plan? Are we making sure? Because nobody can be all things, right? So the jack of all trades and the controller of a consumer is that's history. It's let's get together and figure out how to make it work. Before I let you go, I know you've got another appointment coming up, and I appreciate your time. But the one question I always ask, and it's kind of humorous, but we're doing some research on it, is if you're in a situation, and I don't know how you are, and a lot of entrepreneurs are entertainers as well, but if you're in a room and karaoke is in the game and you're not leaving without singing a song, what's the go-to karaoke song for Pat Hyben? Okay.
The Ballad of Curtis Lowe by Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Oh, love it. I love it. Have you done it?
Oh, yeah.
All right, cool. I won't make you do it on air right now, but at some point you and I will do it and we'll have a lot of fun with it. Hey, man, I appreciate it. I appreciate you offering up that 50% discount to our listeners. Folks, like I said, check him out, Real Estate Rockstars. It's awesome. He's got a really authentic way about him when he's interviewing people. It's very genuine. It's great listening. The tactics are unbelievable. And hey, I really appreciate you, Pat, and I hope to get you back on the show soon.
Thanks, Mark. Good times.
Hey, thanks for joining us today. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to subscribe on your platform of choice for a new episode each week and share this with everyone and anyone. If you have any questions or comments or have an idea for another guest, feel free to shoot me an email at mstiles@stiles-law.com. That's M-S-T-I-L-E-S at stiles-law.com. And if you are a real estate professional, be sure to check us out on our private exclusive Facebook page, The Real Estate School at 892, for content and Massachusetts continuing education opportunities. Be well, folks.